Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You counting on housing to get us out of this recession? Yeah, don't do that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 19th of January. Good to have you with us. The data out today from the U.S. housing market came in three varieties: the good, the bad, and the ugly. Seems easier to get the bad and the ugly out of the way first, and that's where we'll start, and it's all rolled into one, bad and ugly together. Overall, get this, overall, 2011 was the worst year on record for single-family home construction. The good news came in slightly less alarming form. Mortgage applications jumped 23% last week, so in theory, people do want to buy. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has an update now on the ever-confounding American housing market.
For the last half a century, the U.S. built an average of 1.5 million new homes every year. Last year, the U.S. built fewer than half that. Still, Keith Gumbinger with mortgage website HSH.com describes the 2011 housing market as
warming, not warm by any means, but warming. And that's going to start us out into 2012 in a much better position.
And the fact fewer homes are being built is a good thing, says Wharton's Susan Wachter. She says there's a glut of empty homes, and we don't need new ones. And she sees reasons to be optimistic about the overall market.
Housing has never been more affordable. Mortgage rates are at all-time lows. We have job growth, albeit slow. The problem is that shadow supply that's out there.
That's shadow supply. You can think of that as the ghost of foreclosures past. Georgetown University's Adam Levitin explains.
Properties where foreclosure has been started, but maybe not completed. And there's a real backlog in the foreclosure process for a few reasons.
One is the states. Many require judges to approve foreclosures, and courts are backed up. The other problem, says Levitin, allegations that banks illegally foreclosed on people. Those had banks stopping everything to get their paperwork in order.
You can kind of think of this as the pig stuck in the python. The pig is going to work its way out of the python, but it's taking a while.
It's a big pig. It's estimated more than 1 million homes are sitting in the shadows. Levitin says it could take another year or two to exorcise the demons of the housing crash. And until we do, no recovery is safe. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
There have been plenty of not-so-happy Kodak moments for the company of the same name the past couple of years, capped, as you might have heard by now, by last night's filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The company that invented the digital camera nearly 40 years ago never did come close to making up for the profits it lost from the film side of its business. It has tried to make inroads selling printers, and it does still own some really valuable technology patents. But the recession finally pushed Kodak over the edge. Analysts, though, wonder why Kodak failed where its main Japanese rival, Fuji, has thrived. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, with that story.
Even in the face of cutthroat competition from Japanese rivals, as recently as the 1990s, Kodak was consistently rated among the world's most valuable and visible brands.
they really did occupy what seemed like half of the aisle.
Austin Smith is a consumer analyst with the investing website The Motley Fool. The other half of that film aisle he speaks of was dominated by Kodak's chief competitor, Fujifilm. And the way those rivals handle the coming of the digital age is where their roads diverge. Smith says Kodak failed to leverage its own innovation in the digital camera because executives feared it would kill their cash cow film business.
What they failed to recognize is that if they didn't cannibalize their own business with better digital cameras, someone would, and then they'd be left with nothing.
Fuji set out to dominate the most lucrative part of the market with high-end digital cameras, but even then it realized that income could never replace film, so it diversified into medical imaging. It also makes film that's used to improve the viewing angle on flat panel screens, and it even used its chemical expertise in a successful line of cosmetics. Smith says Kodak made only half-hearted attempts at diversifying, but never really succeeded in replacing its lost profits. At the research firm IDC, analyst Chris Schutz suggests executives were too impatient to grow a new business.
Kodak in general always had a benchmark of its film business, which it literally created from the ground up to work against when comparing other types of businesses against it.
Howard Anderson, who teaches at MIT, sees a lesson in Kodak's too slow transformation.
There is a yin and yang to business. And if you're on top today, start to worry because someone else somewhere is working on a technology that's going to make yours obsolete.
That, of course, is how Kodak itself got started more than 130 years ago. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
I'm going to go not too far out on a limb here and guess that most of you don't have any idea how much data your smartphone eats up every month. And for those of you with unlimited data plans, you don't have to worry about it yet. But starting Sunday, new AT&T customers are going to be paying more. They'll get more data for it, sure, but Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports the costs of being connected do just keep on rising.
First, I've got to do the numbers. The average smartphone owner uses around 600 megabytes of data per month. That's according to Nielsen. In video speak, that's roughly an hour on YouTube, or 1,200 stops on the web, or 3,000 emails. AT&T's cheapest plan gives users 20 minutes of straight video. It costs $15 a month, and that's not enough, says tech analyst Jeff Kagan.
Right now, many of the customers are getting burned. And when customers get burned, they're unhappy. When they're unhappy, they leave. And that's what AT&T is trying to stop right now.
It's trying by giving users more data to watch baby pandas, piano playing cats, and dog owners teasing their talking pets about bacon.
So I ate it.
Oh, no. You're kidding me.
Under the new plan, the cheapest tier will give users 30 minutes of straight video, and it costs $20 a month. What's our love of smartphones and tablets doing to our cost of living? Dan Ginsberg tracks inflation for the Bureau of Labor Statistics. His index shows cell phone plans have gone down in price, but data charges?
Any extra prices for additional access we're not currently picking up.
In other words, it's hidden inflation. AT&T says it needs to raise fees so it can boost its network to accommodate its users. But Jeff Kagan says even new plans don't go far enough.
Because customers will be wanting more and asking for more and using more.
For now, though, the main carriers are only looking to increase the data cap. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was fine. I guess another day, another dollar. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There have been lots of numbers coming out of China this week. One of the biggies was a slight slowing in the growth rate of the world's second biggest economy. But the one that really caught our ear was this. Last year, real estate investment in China was worth $200 billion more than what the U.S. put into its real estate market during the height of the bubble here. So if you're thinking, uh-oh, join the club. From Shanghai Marketplace, China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
The European debt crisis, the U.S. debt downgrade, and yet, through it all, China has been one of the economic bright spots in the world. And the real estate market has been a bright spot in the Chinese economy. But not anymore. At this real estate office on the outskirts of Shanghai, only one agent among seven is on the phone. The rest are browsing the internet. Real estate agent Liu Bo says it's been quiet ever since the government limited the number of properties each person can buy to two.
Our sales are down, and it doesn't look like they'll rebound anytime soon.
The runaway growth of the housing market scared Beijing, so the country imposed new laws to slow speculation. If China reverses that course, Liu's sales might pick up, but it could create another housing bubble. If the government continues to curb real estate speculation, the resulting slowdown threatens to drag China's economic growth to below 8%. That's an ominous mark in a land where 8 is a lucky number. IHS Global Insight economist Alistair Thornton says China's government considers GDP growth under 8% as dangerous.
There's been a feeling that 8% has been necessary each year to ensure that employment and social stability holds up, and that the generalized fear is that should growth dip below that magic number, things start to unravel.
Thornton says China's property market slowdown could shave 2 percentage points off of China's GDP growth this year. If that happens, China's economy would be expanding by 6 or 7%, enviable by Western standards. But in China, that's what's known as a hard landing. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Today brought to a close what we in business journalism refer to as bank earnings season. The last two of the big Wall Street banks reported profits today. That'd be Bank of America and Morgan Stanley. B of A did all right, actually made money in the fourth quarter instead of losing like they did a year ago. Morgan Stanley, though, did lose, and that's been closer to the general tone all week. 2011 was not especially kind to the big banks in this country. Our New York bureau chief, Heidi Moore, is here to give us some context on this story. Hey, Heidi.
Hey, Kai.
So what have the numbers this morning taught us? What do we know?
Well, what's interesting is that the big U.S. banks are far less profitable. In fact, they're even shrinking a little.
You have to explain that because too big to fail, all that stuff, right?
Yes. And fear not. That term shall not be leaving us anytime soon. But if you look at what the banks were communicating, it was that 2011 was a year when they got smaller. So Bank of America is getting out of some regions of America. It sold $33 billion of assets that it had. Citigroup is also selling down a lot of that toxic debt that was weighing it down. It also sold a student loan business, a brokerage in Japan. Goldman and Morgan Stanley are talking about things like right-sizing again, too. They're cutting staff and cash bonuses. And so the overall trend is that we're seeing these big behemoths actually take the responsibility to get smaller.
What gives? Why, though? I mean, you know, corporate altruism is great, however, comma.
Yes, altruism is a word that has no place in capitalism, and your skepticism is well-based. What's going on is that you remember how the market was punishing Bank of America stock, dragging it down to $5, even below that? Did it to Citi, to Goldman Sachs, to JP Morgan, all of them. And the banks react to that, right? When you hit their profitability, when a shareholder speaks, they react faster. So you've had regulators for the past 2 years saying you're too big to fail, you have to get smaller. But the market speaks in 1 year and gets it done a lot faster.
Is there still, though, I mean, I joked about it before, they're still really, really big, as in too big to fail big.
Yes, this is just the beginning of the process. I mean, in fact, I think the bigger issue here is that are they too big to succeed, right? And so, you know, for instance, Bank of America has gone from $2.5 trillion in assets, big numbers, to $2.2 trillion in assets. That's still massive. Yeah. That's still a big, big number. They lost some ground. JP Morgan is now the biggest bank in the U.S. They are all still very, very big. But that trend line of them taking their future in their hands and deciding that they need to be smaller is very important.
It sounds, I'm going to ascribe motive here. It sounds like you're saying that's a good thing.
It is, and also it is not. It depends on what side of the fence you're on. So, for instance, I talked to Fred Cannon at Keefe, Bruyette & Woods, and he said something about the dualism here that I thought was very smart.
So the real challenge with these shrinking banks is that on the one hand, they're safer because they have more cash on hand. The bad news, though, is they earn less money.
Okay, wait. Just quickly before I let you go, what does it mean that it's bad that they're making less money?
Well, it just means we're not going to have these big billion-dollar profits anymore. So if we're comfortable with small banks, we have to be comfortable with smaller profits.
And shareholders thus getting rewarded accordingly, right?
Exactly.
All right. Heidi Moore in our New York Bureau. Thank you, Heidi.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, how do you get them back in the classroom after they've gone and dropped out?
Yeah, we're looking at a 5-year plan. So by the time I'm 30, 31, I'll be in good shape.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, what do you know? The Dow Industrials advanced 45 points today, about a 1/3%, closed at 12,623. The NASDAQ gained 18 points, 2/3%, 2788. The S&P 500 picked up 6 points, 0.5%, ended at 1314. Banks made big deposits again. Morgan Stanley jumped more than 5%. Goldman Sachs, riding on yesterday's earnings numbers, added more than 3%. Bank of America up 2 1/3% on an encouraging earnings report, as we mentioned earlier. JP Morgan Chase pocketed 1%, ditto for Citigroup. Lots of tech action after the bell. Google's shares were up 1% before it reported earnings, but then they didn't meet expectations and the stock was pounded after the bell, down as much as 10% at one point. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note was 1.98%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for December. A roundtable discussion on taxes and small business takes place at the National Press Club. And it's billed as the world's biggest fair for food, agriculture, and horticulture. International Green Week Berlin begins. Attendance is expected to exceed 400,000. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So, Rick Perry's out. Seems Rick Santorum was the actual winner in Iowa. In South Carolina, Newt Gingrich is gaining ground. Mitt Romney's trying really hard not to talk about his taxes. But whoever eventually does win the Republican nomination, one main theme of the rest of the campaign is already pretty clear. It's going to be big corporations versus big government. And so the winner might well hinge on what the American people really think about that.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
We talk to Frank Newport every week. He's the editor-in-chief of Gallup for a segment we call Attitude Check, about what the American people really do think. Frank, it's good to have you back.
Good to be with you.
So we have federal government. We have big business, obviously, in this country. They both elicit strong emotions. When you asked around, which do people like more?
It's pick your poison, is the way I would look at it. Americans don't like either. 29% are satisfied with the federal government. 30% are satisfied with the size and power of major corporations, which means for politicians who are criticizing just one, you have to be careful because Americans don't have any love lost for either of those huge entities.
Can you drill down a little bit? And do you know what it is that they don't like? Because off the top of my head, I can think of like a dozen of each.
We think the word big is important. Huh. In other words, anything that's large today, Americans don't like. And of course, the government is huge. Americans just have a lot more sympathy for things that are small rather than big. And we said major corporations, and that just evokes a viscerally negative reaction from the average American.
Does it break down along party lines the way you'd think? Republicans generally favoring corporations and Democrats being in favor of government?
Ah, brilliant insight. Indeed,
it does. That's why I get to do the show.
Absolutely. And that fits with the rank and file. Republicans are much more sympathetic to big corporations and Democrats to the government. So you have to be very careful, as I mentioned. If you're going to criticize one, you want to sneak in some criticism of the other. And by the way, Obama's done that. You may not have noticed it, but he came out in the last week or two and said, oh, we need to consolidate these federal agencies and reduce the size of government. So his strategists have told him, don't just rail against big corporations, but say some negative things about government as well.
Maybe they're reading the Gallup data, Frank, in the White House, right?
I think they do.
Surely there must be parts, though, of both government and corporations that people like, right? I mean, we can't all be downers all the time.
Absolutely. And small is beautiful. This is fascinating. We have a question we ask every year. How much confidence do you have in these institutions? We use the word business, and we insert the adjective small, and then we insert the adjective big. And there's a huge difference. Small business is second from the top. Only the military engenders more confidence in America than small business. So if you're small, that's good. We find the same thing on government. Local government's much more positively evaluated than that big federal government there in Washington.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The segment we do with him every week is called Attitude Check, and you can find it and some of the data as well on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
You bet.
It's not the iPhone 5, it's not the iPad 3, but there was a big Apple product announcement today. A new version of its iBooks software geared at providing interactive student textbooks, which would be read, of course, on the iPad. The potential hurdles are many, including the fact that iPads still cost around $500 as a bargain basement price. But we wanted to get away from the business case study and explore what this might eventually mean in the classroom, should it work out. So we called Katie Cohen. Until June of last year, she was a high school science teacher in the Los Angeles Unified School District. Katie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
So listen, in an ideal world, if all your students had had iPads, what would that have meant for you as a teacher?
Well, probably number one, that meant that all of them would come to class with their textbooks, because I taught science, and sometimes it was really hard for them to bring their text. I had so many excuses about how big they were, how heavy, etc. A better way to say that is that it would have been something cool for them. It would have been a new way to connect them to the classroom. You know, a lot of my students were so technology savvy when it came to things like iPods, but when it came to academic technology, I felt like a lot of them were struggling in that area.
Okay, so let's get to the real world now, where, you know, in the Los Angeles School District, as in many school districts around the country, it's not like they can drop $500 for iPads for everybody.
No, they can't. In the school that I taught at, and in a lot of schools in LAUSD, they're currently struggling to provide basics for their students, like glue sticks and paper and pencils. So I really don't understand how they would have any more money for iPads or Kindles or e-textbooks.
But, yeah, but step back for me for a minute, though, because isn't there a digital divide question here? Because there will be districts in many cities and towns across this country where they can drop $500 for an iPad and buy e-textbooks. And yet a lot of kids in other parts won't have it. Then what happens?
You know, I really think that you already see that kind of division where there's the haves and the have-nots. You know, if you go in the direction of e-textbooks, of Kindles, of iPads, and you don't provide them at the public school level, you will just create this further divide where some people are more technologically savvy than others.
You know, I said in the introduction that you're a former teacher. Many reasons, obviously, why people make career changes. Is this one of them? Is this the struggles of education? Is that one of them?
I really felt pushed and pulled out because I wanted to work in healthcare, and now I can do that. I have the opportunity. I'm in school for that. On the other hand, if I felt that I could have the freedom to teach in the way that I wanted to teach and be compensated in the way that was appropriate for my work and my education level, then there is the possibility that I would have stayed.
Katie Cohen used to be a teacher at Grant High School here in the Los Angeles Unified School District. She's in graduate school now, in healthcare, as she said. Katie, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
However students get their textbooks, on an iPad or the old-fashioned way, those books aren't going to do any good unless they're actually used, which is a way to get to this. There are 37 million people in this country who've started college, who have some credits, but never finished. And when they do that, when they drop out, there are costs, to them, of course, but to the rest of us as well, in the billions of dollars in wasted loans and grants and lost opportunities. Those costs are one reason that college dropouts are starting to get more attention from the Obama administration on down. But finding ways for people to finish their degrees might mean rethinking the way Americans go to college. Emily Hanford of American Radio Works has that story.
For a long time, no one paid much attention to how many people were dropping out of college. Hadass Sheffer is executive director of a Philadelphia program that helps former students come back. She says the attitude was,
you dropped out, it's your fault. And we're saying no. We have so many people who are not finishing college. To me, that's a systems failure. It's not the failure of the individuals.
Stan Jones of Complete College America agrees.
The colleges that we have now were really designed for traditional students that came out of good college prep high schools, lived in the dormitory, went full-time.
Today's college students don't fit that profile. Most of them commute to campus, and nearly a third have full-time jobs. Finishing a degree is tough.
Between leaving work and getting out to the college, there was no dinner fix, there was nothing done. My world was crazy.
Marilyn Johnson Jackson could only manage the stress of night classes, two jobs, and life as a single mom for so long. She gave up on the idea of ever getting her degree and then discovered a new online program. At first, she was skeptical.
How can you take a class online? I just didn't get the concept.
But once she started,
I like this. I can get out of the bed and walk right in here to my computer, do my homework, and I'm through for the day.
Getting students like Jackson to come back by offering flexible and convenient programs was once a market owned mostly by for-profit colleges. But traditional schools are catching on. Jackson finished her degree online through a community college. John McGee did too. Online, he could move at his own pace and didn't have to sit through a typical 16-week semester.
Learning became interesting because I felt like, man, I'm finally accomplishing something.
As a working professional with 7 years of military service, McGee didn't like taking classes with 18-year-olds. The online program allowed him to get credit for his experience. McGee finished an associate's degree in less than a year and quickly got two promotions. Seems straightforward. But for people figuring out how to get back to school, finding the right program can be a daunting task.
I didn't know where to start, who to contact. I didn't have a clue.
Julia Capizzi quit college 5 years ago when juggling work and school got the best of her. She's now a city clerk, but without a degree, she isn't eligible for promotion. Desperate to finish, but not knowing how, she finally found Graduate Philadelphia, a city-supported program that helps dropouts come back.
Hey, Julia. Thanks. Come on back.
Thank you.
Capizzi is meeting with her counselor at the Comebacker Center, located in a downtown mall. Photos of smiling graduates hang from the ceiling.
Okay, so all the other paperwork that had to get over to the admissions office, you've gotten it there?
Yes. Mailed out my transcripts on Monday.
Capizzi is applying to an associate's program in business. She'd hoped to finish the science degree she started, but the classes weren't offered online or at night. So she's pretty much starting over. Her goal is to eventually transfer for a bachelor's.
Yeah, we're looking at a 5-year plan. So by the time I'm 30, 31, I'll be in good shape.
Capizzi says she wishes she'd finished her degree the first time around, but plan B is better than no plan at all. I'm Emily Hanford for Marketplace.
You can find a link to Emily's American Radio Works documentary, Some College, No Degree, it's called, on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which is either the biggest cop-out or the smartest political move ever. Herman Cain made his long-awaited endorsement today, and you might think, on the day that Rick Perry dropped out and backed Newt Gingrich, that the time would be ripe for a politically opportune announcement. Cain has suggested he'd like to be defense secretary, you know. Alas, it was not to be. Instead, Cain endorsed us, the people, he said. Seriously. So, I mean, what does that mean? I don't know. Anyway. All right, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, this Thursday. Today, the Dow advanced 45 points, about a third percent. The NASDAQ up 18 points, two-thirds of 1%. The S&P 500 picked up 6 points. That's a half percent there. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the broadcast...
This is not rocket science. For most people, you want to have a super PAC, fine. You file a one-page letter.
Your guide to super PACs just in time for the South Carolina primary. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.